It was to limit Iran's peaceful nuclear program in return for lifting economic nuclear-related UN sanctions off this country. Trump's USA unilaterally pulled out of the deal in 2018 and reinforced UN sanctions as US sanctions. Now, what's the significance here? Again, the JCPOA was originally intended to lift economic sanctions off Iran. This meant China could now deal with Iran. But with Donald Trump's reimposed sanctions, secondary sanctions for China, the Eastern Alliance was put off till today, when China also finds itself directly and separately under U.S. sanctions.
In Asia, we have China in the East and Iran in the West. Both have suffered from Western colonization, especially by Britain and the United States. Both have been kept under severe pressure throughout history. They're being pressured by excuses such as human rights and any other issue we can think of. To set themselves free, they find themselves in a situation where they need to get together to take advantage of each other's capacities in the face of the West's growing pressure and enter into a contract to put their strengths together and be able to defend each other in such an environment.
So you see why there's been so much scaremongering against the Iran-China agreement by media stemming in unfriendly states, giving the Iranian people the idea its government would in desperate times be ceding parts of the country to China. Officials with an insight into detail of the deal are all on board with the agreement, even as we near presidential elections, and that is a time typically of bitter infighting.
The reason why countries are moving towards long-term cooperation is that they want to free themselves from the daily political turmoil and work together for their long-term interests. They show each other they are interested in friendship and development of their relations for a long time. Therefore, such documents cannot be related to domestic politics or which government is incumbent or which party has the power. In this context, this document, which was signed as a comprehensive cooperation program between Iran and China, shows that the two countries are ready to cooperate at the highest level.
The reason why Iran and China have picked each other is partly to secure their bilateral interests where the West has failed their interests. Of course, as with any major project, Iran will have to keep an eye on how business is conducted.
In practice, some collaborations may run into challenges. For example, the troll fishing was one of those challenges. The issue was proposed in the parliament. This type of fishing is not done anymore because of the environmental damages and other risks it poses. When drawing up a contract, all national interests consideration must be taken into account. Whether environmental, political, territorial integrity, or security, all of these must be taken into account.
As Western partners to the JCPOA are now pushing a spanner in the works for Iran and China, JCPOA talks may have been a ray of hope in Iran-China talks as early as 2014. But that's all it was, a ray of hope by getting sanctions out of the way of the inevitable. The Cross-Asian Alliance means a great deal to the old continent's two ancient civilizations, all else aside.
One issue that the Chinese have emphasized over the years and continue to do so is the establishment of political and economic relations on the basis of culture. The Silk Road provides the basis for this idea of Belt and Road. The Silk Road is not just about economics. It connects countries whose cultures are intertwined. Chinese leaders openly say one of the reasons they've proposed the Silk Road initiative was because of its cultural aspect.
What are the Chinese looking for in the region? The Chinese are looking for stable oil and energy sources in our region. They now consume 11.5 million barrels per day and seek to ensure that the investments they make here are safe. No security in the region is possible without the participation of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iran is looking for a loyal customer and investor to expand its economy like any other nation. All countries are now talking about attracting foreign investment.
We've still plenty more to cover, but first a quick review of other media outlets to see what others have to say. Do bear with me. And here's what other outlets say. The Times of Israel points to how the deal may reduce U.S. influence. Iran-China signed huge 25-year strategic deal could reduce U.S. regional influence. The deal signed Saturday could undermine U.S. leverage over Iran ahead of expected negotiations, and it can lessen American influence in the Middle East. Ongoing U.S. sanctions against Iran could hamper its trade with China despite Saturday's agreement, however. Iran's government and people are striving, as they always have, to broaden relations with trustworthy, independent countries like China. Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said back in 2016, describing the then-proposed cooperation agreement as correct and reasonable. Iran has, since Trump exited the Iran nuclear deal, pulled away from restrictions imposed under the deal, under those sanctions, in order to put pressure on other signatories, Germany, France, Britain, Russia, and China, to provide new economic incentives to offset U.S. sanctions. Iran is also believed to be maneuvering for leverage ahead of expected negotiations with the Biden administration. The National points to how the Middle East might change structure under the agreement. Will the China-Iran deal change the Middle East? It should come as no surprise that China and Iran signed a 25-year agreement this week. What is interesting, however, is the timing. It comes within 100 days of U.S. President Joe Biden taking office and his desire to reconfigure America's relations with both countries. Now, it seems Beijing and Tehran have moved past the era of fearing U.S. sanctions following the departure of Mr. Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump. Interestingly, even as they prioritize their relations with Iran, China and Russia are also deepening cooperation with the Persian Gulf states. Last month, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov toured the region, as did Wang Yi, his Chinese counterpart. Mr. Lavrov also visited Beijing to coordinate the two countries' strategies regarding relations with the U.S., the Persian Gulf states, and the Middle East, amid the Biden administration's perceived downgrading of the region in its list of priorities. A word from Tehran Times, the Iranian paper, chooses China. China is an ideal partner for Iran's pluralistic diplomacy. Smart Iranians must have learned from the history of Iran since the 19th century that only when Iran establishes balanced and pluralistic diplomacy will it better defend its own interests and gain more benefits. In a multipolar world, Iran certainly needs pluralistic diplomacy. In recent years, there have been many analytical articles about Look East in Iran, and the international academic community is also studying Iran's Look East. If Iran's Look East more than a decade ago was just to respond to U.S. sanctions, currently Iran's Look East should have a different meaning. It should become one of Iran's long-term strategies to safeguard its own interests. Eastern countries have their own development philosophy. For example, compared with Western powers, China knows better that countries need to respect each other. As a major Asian country, Iran should have more optimistic expectations for the future of the East. And that would be it for the news segment. Back to innovation. For China, comprehensive strategic partnerships are a standard foreign policy tool. It has signed them with over 80 countries. And it has been signing roadmaps for economic and security cooperation with countries across the Middle East. This would ensure it does not provoke regional rivalries. This is apart from the fact that China has singular interests with each Middle Eastern country. Now, Iran is a regional superpower rich in oil, so it can't very well be omitted from the equation. And Iran, for its part, won't sit back to get left out as China strikes deals in the neighborhood. And anyway, all aside, power equations in the world are changing. China has something to say for itself and the clout to secure its interests.
You need to consider that the Arab countries in the Persian Gulf also have ports that are safe, advanced, and quite attractive to Chinese. So there is this competitive environment for Iran to create an attraction for the Chinese side to move toward Iran. Of course, Iran's energy bases like Azalea oil and gas fields are important factors that can serve as a starting point for Iran to enter into negotiations with China. This means that outside the issue of the Silk Road, which which is an international plan, we can begin two-way cooperation with China in the energy sector. That is, we can use the 25-year deal to act directly and without the need of any intermediaries to transfer energy from Iranian ports to Chinese ports or any other ports they would determine.
The centers of power in the international system are shifting and changing. The 21st century is a century of Asia. The center of power is transferred from the West, which used to be in Europe, to the East, that is Asia. Due to the shifting of the center of power, new coalitions are also being formed.
Also, Iran and China are natural partners in what is an extension of the One Belt, One Road initiative. For China, the initiative guarantees its access to the four corners of a world it is set to dominate as the soon-to-be number one economic power. And Iran, apart from guaranteeing oil exports to this country, is naturally located on the choke point between Asia and Europe. China is taking a great leap forward in asserting itself as a superpower, and its interests in the Middle East are tied with those of Iran. In the power struggle between the U.S. and China, the scales have tilted in favor of China, and Iran will be acting as a balancing element.
One of the characteristics of Chinese diplomacy is the principle of separation. The Chinese easily communicate with the Israelis and at the same time with Saudi Arabia and Iran. Most important is the United States. The U.S. is at war with China. They're engaged in a trade war, but the relations are still there. China has separated its ties with Iran and other states in the region. If you think carefully, the Chinese leader's latest trip to the region showed the same principle. Before he visited Iran, the Chinese leader paid a visit to Saudi Arabia. This has a message for us. We have a Persian poem that says everyone is important in its way. China has a distinct definition for diplomacy with Iran and Saudi Arabia, and they won't interfere with each other.
I've said much of the agreement, but little of its contents. What Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif described as a long-term practical promotion will provide a win-win platform for the comprehensive development of cooperation in trade, politics, economy, culture, defense, and security between the two ancient Asian civilizations. It will provide equal sovereignty and secure an indigenous development model. It will promote and facilitate joint production in the fields of oil, industry, mining, and energy-related fields based on national sustainable development and environmental concerns. Iran's effective participation in the Belt and Road Initiative, cooperation in the fields of infrastructure, communication, railroad, port and air and telecommunications, financial banking and customs cooperation and deregulation, cooperation in the development of special and free trade and industrial zones, including on the Makran coast, strengthening non-oil cooperation with a focus on the knowledge-based field, facilitating private sector cooperation by removing barriers to cooperation, tourism, media, non-governmental organization, friendship associations, and academic cooperation. The list goes on and on.
If you analyze foreign media, including Manator, Iran International, and the BBC, they're saying that the means of maximum pressure campaign with its murky and dangerous methods have taken Iran thus far to a point where they either can achieve what they were after or they won't. And if this deal relieves that pressure all of a sudden, this extraordinary disgraceful investment they had made will be rendered useless. So they're drawing comparisons with the treaty of Turkmenchai, talking about selling off the country and such. One of the reasons behind these histrionics is that they sold off their homeland and this deal is going against it.
Zarif also clarified misconceptions about the plan, posting on Instagram, "This document is not a contract, but has provided the grounds for future contracts. It does not create any exclusive rights in any field, and the deployment of any military force has not been foreseen in this document, and there is no possibility to take over a base." Regarding military cooperation, the agreement does not promise a steadfast military alliance, because for one thing, China's Middle East arms trade is directed towards Iran's neighbors, who are willing to pay in petrodollars rather than petroleum itself. Also, Iran seeks air defense weaponry, while China itself struggles to manufacture jet engines, and its new drones have crashed in the field. China's main sales in West Asia are tanks.
More than 80 countries in the world now have China as their first trading partner. Not just Iran currently has China as its top trading partner. In 2020, our non-oil foreign trade with China alone was over $19 billion. Well, this is a considerable amount in Iran's foreign trade. And in the current situation, the American media and American institutions themselves report that Iran's oil sales to China last month were close to 1 million barrels per day. These are all signs that China's potentials are currently expanding. All countries tend to design long-term, mutually beneficial relations with such a country. Iran is no exception.
Our proposal in the Foreign Relations Strategy Committee has been that sanctioned nations form what we called an anti-sanctions bloc. It's natural for them to come together. The countries which they closed the way for is now opening the path for each other in financial issues. It's no longer a matter of ideology. We aren't communists and neither are they. We don't want to convert them to Islam, nor do they want to make us communists. Like everywhere in the world, it's a game played by several powers. You close the way for us, but the way is open for us elsewhere.
Europeans have been conveying to Iranians that China can't be good for them as a state that won't care about human rights issues in this country. But as early as November 2016, the UK and China agreed to deepen ties between their financial services industries. Britain was pushing to establish London as a global hub for Chinese finance. In West Asia, China signed cooperation deals with Iraq in 2015, Saudi Arabia in 2016, and the United Arab Emirates in 2018.
For a long time, the U.S. is said to have shifted its foreign relations activities from this region, once deemed as quite important for Washington, to the Indo-Pacific region. This means that the U.S. presence in the region will be diminishing. That would open up opportunities in the area for other powers, including China, and also regional powers like Iran.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after, as you never know where we are going to take you next. Bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
in the limelight.
For years, it had been assumed that superior skills in facial recognition could be taught and would help those working in police and security agencies to make more accurate judgments about a person's identity. While this is true up to a point, research has found that the remarkable abilities demonstrated by super recognizers can't be learned. Researchers think they are coded into our DNA, and only a very small proportion of people have the genetic disposition to develop these extreme abilities. Dr. James Dunn from the University of New South Wales in Australia says, "The term super-recognizers was coined by researchers in 2009 in response to some of the exceptional results people were achieving on face recognition tests. In statistical terms, super-recognizer describes anyone who scores two standard deviations above the average person. In other words, a person in the top 1 or 2% of the population." Dr. James Dunn said, "What we've found is that face recognition varies naturally, like IQ does. And just like IQ, it appears that a large proportion of that variance is genetically determined." We now present you an article written by researchers at the University of New South Wales in Australia under the heading, "Super Recognizers Possess Extraordinary Ability to Memorize and Recall Faces." The article has been taken from the SciTechDaily.com website. Please stay with us for more. While in Paris, France in the 1990s, Georgie briefly watched a professional photographer taking pictures of kids playing in a small park near Les Halles and thought nothing of it. 10 years later, she was having breakfast in Australia's Byron Bay backpackers and asked the man next to her whether he was a photographer and if he had ever taken pictures of children playing in a Paris park. Amazed, he only said that he was and that he had. He even showed her his portfolio of the actual pictures she had witnessed him taking a decade earlier. Coincidences like these would probably go unnoticed by most of us, but Georgie has a special ability that only 2% of the world's population is endowed with. She is a super recognizer. Such people possess an extraordinary ability to memorize and recall faces of people they may have only encountered in the most unremarkable and sometimes fleeting situations, often many years before. In research published in PLOS-1, psychologists from the Forensic Psychology Laboratory at University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia, argue that the freely available University of New South Wales face test, which they have been using since 2017 to identify the world's best performing super recognizers, is a perfect screening tool to sort the good, the very good, and the exceptional face recognizers from the rest of the population. The researchers, including Dr. James Dunn, Scientia Fellow Dr. David White, and Dr. Alice Towler, say the University of New South Wales face test is able to provide more precision when it comes to ranking the abilities of super recognizers, especially when used in conjunction with existing face recognition tests, like the Glasgow Face Matching Test and the Cambridge Face Memory Test. The University of New South Wales face test was deliberately designed by the researchers to be very challenging. As a result, average performers rank at the low end of the scale. Unlike other existing tests where performance of candidates is more evenly spread across the measurement scale. Out of 31,000 people who have taken the University of New South Wales face test since 2017, nobody has ever scored 100%. The highest anyone has achieved is 97%. This means the person with the best facial recognition abilities in the world could still be out there. Dr. James Dunn says, when people do the University of New South Wales face test, they discover it's really difficult, with most people scoring between 50 and 60%. He says, but super recognizers are people who score 70% and higher. We made it difficult so that it's not too easy for the very best super recognizers, adding, when super recognizers do the traditional face test, they max out at 100%, which means it's difficult for us to differentiate between the very good and the exceptionally good. Dr. James Dunn notes, if anybody came to us thinking they may be a super recognizer, we would start them on the University of New South Wales face test and then get them to do further confirmatory tests and say, you need to do well on all of them for us to be confident that you're a super recognizer. For many years, it had been assumed that superior skills in facial recognition could be taught and would help those working in police force and security agencies to make more accurate judgments about a person's identity. While this is true up to a point, new research has found that the remarkable abilities demonstrated by super recognizers can't be learnt. Researchers think they are coded into our DNA, and only a very small proportion of the population have the genetic disposition to develop these extreme abilities. Dr. James Dunn says, the term super recognizers was coined by researchers in 2009 in response to some of the exceptional results people were achieving on face recognition tests. In statistical terms, super recognizer describes anyone who scores two standard deviations above the average person. In other words, a person in the top 1 or 2% of the population. Dr. James Dunn continues, what we've found is that face recognition varies naturally like IQ does, and just like IQ, it appears that a large proportion of that variance is genetically determined. The University of New South Wales researchers are interested in super recognizers for two reasons. First of all, the more scientists learn about super recognizers and how they process faces, the more they can decode what is going on in the brain when we see both familiar and unfamiliar faces. And secondly, governments and commercial organizations are increasingly searching for people with superior face recognition abilities. Dr. James Dunn adds, we are starting to see industries looking within and outside of their organizations for super recognizers to work in specialized face identification roles. He added, this can include police, but may also include government and commercial bodies like immigration, intelligence agencies, security agencies, financial institutions, and even coffee shops. According to new research, there are no other common traits shared among super recognizers besides their skill itself. Super recognizers come from all walks of life and have the same spread of intelligence profiles as the general population. While many may not realize they are super recognizers, some had an inkling they were pretty good with faces at a young age. Nicole was just 11 years old when she realized she could recognize all her teacher's baby faces in a competition at her school. She says, when everyone else was struggling to find just a couple of faces they knew, I correctly identified all 20 faces very easily. At the time, I thought it was strange, but it felt super cool too. Likewise, Wai Yin said she first realized she was a super recognizer when still a teenager. She added, I used to look at magazines and circle people's faces instead of looking at the clothes. That's when I thought there's something weird going on. For Kelly, it wasn't until she sat at the University of New South Wales face test and was contacted by researchers that she even knew that she had the skill. But she adds, I have always been a perfectionist and had an extremely abnormal eye for detail with everything. A lot of super recognizers start to wonder about their gift when watching television. Jessica says, my husband and I were arguing over somebody on television looking like someone else, adding, My husband said he thought he was pretty good at recognizing faces and Googled and found the University of New South Wales's online test. He completed it and achieved around 50%. She says, I completed the test and had a much higher score and thought, yes, I'm definitely better at recognizing faces than my husband. Automatic win on that topic. It wasn't until the University of New South Wales researchers contacted me that I realized my score was not within the normal range. I joined a lot of dots after that. Most see the skill as a gift that makes life more interesting or even helps in one's career. Duncan says being a super recognizer has helped in his line of work, which is recruitment. Duncan says, people are always extremely flattered when you remember them, or if we haven't actually met in person and have only seen their picture on social media, they are usually pretty shocked. But others with the gift are a bit more cautious about exposing it. Marcus says, it can make things quite awkward. Marcus added, I'm quite social, so I tend to walk up to people and remember, and I soon realize they don't remember me. Sally resorts to hiding her skill. She says, I often have to lie that I've never met or seen people before, adding, it freaks them out. Or I saw you last week at Woolworths. Makes you sound like a stalker. Amanda reports a similar observation. She says, on a daily basis, I have given up on saying things to people like, hello, we were talking in the queue at Coles supermarket last week. Do you remember me? I just got too many weird looks and I started to feel like I was creepy sometimes, again thinking people would recognize me like I can recognize them. In the end, David says the super recognizer trait can be a mixed blessing. David added, being good at recognition comes with its own problems, feeling like the world is too small sometimes, but it has its good parts too. It's allowed me in the leisure industry to build a good rapport with customers, and I can remember every single customer. Having developed the University of New South Wales face desk to find super recognizers, the research team now plans to invite many of them into the laboratory to understand exactly why they are so super at face recognition.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. Witness Donald Williams says he made a 911 call to police to report the police because he believed that he had witnessed a murder. This is from one of the eyewitnesses to the killing of George Floyd, the African-American man killed in Minneapolis by a white police officer, Derek Chauvin, last year. Chauvin put his knee on Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 25 seconds while the victim kept saying, I can't breathe. The Chauvin trial is currently taking place, and Floyd's family is hoping the former policeman will be convicted, but other families whose loved ones have been killed by police in the U.S. say, even with a video, there is no guarantee that a white cop will be convicted of murdering a black man.
The murder trial of Derek Chauvin, a former American cop who knelt on the neck of an unarmed black man for about 9 minutes in Minneapolis last May. Chauvin is charged with the death of that arrested man, George Floyd. The first week of the trial was marked by dramatic and emotional accounts. An eyewitness broke down in tears while responding to prosecutors.
I heard him keep trying to ask them to let him up so he can't breathe. And even I said to the officer, I said, man, he said he can't breathe. And he said, well, if he keep talking, he can breathe.
Floyd's partner of nearly 3 years also got very emotional while testifying. One of the key moments of the trial was on the fifth day of the proceedings. That's when a senior homicide investigator called Chauvin's use of force on Floyd totally unnecessary.
First of all, pulling him down to the ground, face down, and putting your knee on the neck for that amount of time is just uncalled for.
What level of force might that be?
That would be the top tier, the deadly force.
Why?
Because of the fact that if your knee is on a person's neck, that can kill him.
Many Americans also say Floyd's death has had profound emotional and psychological consequences for them.
It's very traumatic for a black person to follow a trial of a black person who was innocently murdered.
I think it's opened a lot of people's minds to be on the lookout for discrimination.
And so I think that a lot of people, or maybe of my color, have been suffering from that sort of PTSD and trauma.
We also have to have that conversation of what is the role of the police.
One can say that what unites all these people is the trauma of watching the death of a black man under the knee of a white police officer. Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to the charges against him. His lawyers argue that Floyd died due to drug overdose. That's while medical examiners have said his death was homicide at the hands of police. The case of George Floyd is undoubtedly a clear example of police injustice and brutality in the United States. His death has already become a symbol of a rallying cry for a global movement against systemic racism and discrimination. But how many other victims are needed for U.S. police to stop abusing their power, especially against minorities in a country known for its racial diversity?
I'd like to welcome my guests to this debate, founder Uhuru Movement, Omaili Yeshitala out of St. Petersburg, Florida, and writer and social justice activist Yanni Ndeko out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start it off in St. Petersburg. And Omaili, black Americans are 1.5 times more, 2.5 times more likely to be killed by police than whites, and police officers are less likely to be indicted for killing a black person as opposed to others. What exactly does this mean?
It means several things. One thing that it means for sure is that African states constitute a domestic colony, and that Africans in the United States are treated just like colonized people are treated globally. All over the world, you see the same kind of thing, so that even though you may have a particular law that they claim is applicable to everybody equally, the fact is that the colonizer and the colonized have a different relationship to laws that have been created by the colonizer for the purpose of upholding colonialism. And that's why you can see the difference in the number and the percentage of African people, the police, as compared to white people who are the settler colonizers inside the United States. The same would hold true in Israel with Palestinians and with the Israeli citizens. And all over the world, you see a similar kind of thing. That's what we're looking at in the United States.
Well, Yanni, it appears that when there is a black victim of police violence, there is immediate demonization of the victim, not the accused murderer. Do you agree or not with that? And if so, why is it the case?
Definitely, I agree with that. You can see examples of that. Even when you look at the recent murder that there was a white man that murdered a bunch of individuals. You know, that in a Chinese hate situation. you know, as it relates to what Brother O'Malley spoke about as the difference between how the colonizers, those who represent the colonizers, are treated compared to those who are amongst part of the colonized communities, that individual was extended a lot of grace. You know, they said he was having a bad day. There was a lot of passion, all this recognition of his humanity. Whereas whenever it's a black victim, the first thing that people attempt to do, and that was with a person who actually was not even a victim, but actually murdered people. But when you're dealing with a black victim, a person who is murdered by the police, one of the first things that they seek to do is find anything they can in order to undermine the character of that individual, and that's ultimately in order to give the both individuals who relate to the state, and particularly within the white community, who play a role of actually like of interceders between the rest of the oppressed class and the colonizing ruling class. Those individuals need excuses in order to be able to continue to stand up for an unjust environment like the militarizing of our communities and the police, the roles that the police play. And so they give them excuses in order to be able to say, see, it was okay, this person was a bad person, and it's not the police aren't bad. The police are victims because they're not being understood as individuals who are having to go up against these really terrible individuals, these terrible entities, even though these are unarmed people, these are people who are not posing any threats, and regardless of whatever happened in their background, they weren't on trial, and it is not the police's right to execute them.
Well, O'Malley, if we're talking about the U.S., a country that has been built on systemic racism, should there be expectations that justice can be served via the court system?
I think, generally speaking, you cannot achieve justice. The colonized cannot achieve justice through the colonial system. And I think the great fear that the United States is confronted with right now is that, particularly as a consequence of this particular trial, where there and the case of the murder of George Floyd, where millions of people, African people as well as the world, were able to see that murder happen and to collectivize it and to hear the testimony, where every African who listened to another African talk about how helpless they felt and how shame and guilty they feel because they didn't do something, I think there's a growing consciousness among the African population that would take us back to that place where African people had come to understand that the enemy is colonialism and that we cannot achieve any kind of justice under this foreign alien domination of our people, and that we have to fight for power over our own lives. This is the thing that led to J. Edgar Hoover, who has come to be the notorious head of the domestic political police in the United States called the FBI. This is what led him to say that the struggle for black power in the United States as represented by the Black Panther Party was the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States. That is because they recognize that this whole rotten social system that murders and brutalizes people all around the world does the same thing in the communities here inside the United States, and that once this people stand up, the whole system stands to be crushed. And I think that's what we're going to see more and more. And I think especially after this trial, where each of us had an opportunity to experience the murder of George Floyd as something that, if given an opportunity, we should have done something, would have done something, want to do something, I think you're going to see more direct participation by African people to stop it and to turn it over. That's the struggle against colonialism. That's where we will find our justice.
Yane, we saw mass demonstrations last year across the country after George Floyd's murder. What has happened since then? Has the situation improved for African Americans?
Well, the situation, as is suggested by Chairman O'Malley, the situation is not going to improve for people of African descent here or anywhere in the world until the system is upended. Actually, it's even, you know, another example of injustice is Brother Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is incarcerated for a crime that he did not commit. And he wrote a book called Murder Incorporated, and in that book he wrote about the white republic, and he talks about the fact that from the beginning, with the first congressional act of the nation, the Naturalization Act of 1790, it limited nationalization to all free white people, to all free white persons. And so even at that time, and this is the core upon which this nation has been built, that this settler nation has been built, that this has always been a situation where laws are applied differently depending on who it is that the subject is. So people of African descent are at times able to find individuals' pieces of justice because there's an effort to sow confusion amongst the various oppressed communities here. But ultimately, nothing about these laws are intended to be the benefit of any working class people of any race. And so the only way that those who are considered the primary target, the base of the oppression hierarchy, which are black people, are going to find justice is by upending the entire system and living under our own rule and having self-determination.
Well, Amali, the mother of Eric Garner, who was killed by police in New York, while he, too, was saying he could not breathe, has said that even with the video showing the murder of a black person, it does not equate to the murderer being convicted. Your take on that, and if that happens to be the case this time around, that the former police officer is not convicted, how do you think that that is going to affect? Will we see mass demonstrations again or even more?
Well, first of all, I want to agree with the assumptions that were made by Mother Eric Garner's mother that there is no guarantee, even with video and what have you. And also with the statement that was made by Sister Yanni that the fact is that it's quite possible that given the severity of the condemnation, the how wide the witness of George Floyd's murder, the fact that within 3 months after his murder, there was something like 10,000 demonstrations, protests, and even uprisings in the United States and more than 60 countries around the United States. We saw people protesting his murder, all of whom are responding to a reality not only of George Floyd, but also of the fact that the whole world lives under a form of colonial domination by U.S. and European imperialism and are fighting against that. So it's a possibility that the U.S. government, the state itself, in a way to obscure its responsibility for the colonial domination of African people, will throw George with Derek Chauvin to the wolves. That's some possibility. If they need it, they'll do it in order to obscure the relationship that the state has. That's why you even hear local media, ruling class media here, talk about Chauvin being a former police officer. He wasn't a former police officer when he killed him. He murdered George Floyd as an arm of a domestic colonial state apparatus. And so if necessary to obscure, to protect the state and the colonial relationship that they have, they would definitely allow for and create the conditions for Derek Chauvin to go to trial. And yes, I do anticipate more demonstrations, but I'm telling you that regardless of what the outcome of is in this trial, the situation has changed. Because as opposed to those circumstances where separate and individual communities experience the death and the murder, which happens every day, it's ubiquitous. What happened to George Floyd is not unusual. What's unusual is the masses of people around the world. People had an opportunity. I guarantee what the outcome of this trial.
Stay with me, Amali. Stay with me. I want to get back to that at the end. But let me cross back over to Yannette. Now, there are so many situations and circumstances that black people have been killed by police, it is said, from being black while playing at the park to being black while shopping at Walmart to being black while changing lanes while driving can all end up fatally, as it has for some victims. Explain what this means, especially for our viewers that are less familiar with the reality on the ground in the United States.
What it ultimately means is that as a black person within the United States, you cannot walk around in your life and feel that you are ever safe. You can be sleeping in your bed next to your boyfriend, who then protects you because somebody is breaking into your home, and you can be murdered. You can be sleeping on your sofa, and that was the case of Breonna Taylor. You can be sleeping on your sofa in your grandmother's house at 7 years old and have somebody bust into your house and blow your brains out of your head, which is the case of what happened with Ayanna Stanley Jones. And so there's no ability for a person to walk through and to feel like there's some special thing that you can do. A lot of times people will say, well, you should have just listened to the officer, you should have cooperated, and it doesn't really matter what you do. There's actually been video of a person who was being confronted with police, and they were giving him the most impossible collection of orders. And this man had to be completely afraid that he was going to be murdered, because there's nothing you can do if you are of African descent being confronted by police in order to guarantee your safety, and it doesn't matter who you are if you are in black skin. And so that is what it means why we say things like driving while black or shopping while black, because your blackness, it overshadows your humanity in the context of this colonial settler state, this white republic, in which the laws and all of the agents all of the individuals who act as agents of the law are protected in order to move it against, move things in the best interest of the ruling class and uphold the status quo.
Oh, Miley, what does all this mean? You've heard what our other guest has just said, and you said that this time around you think it's different. Where is it all going in the United States? Where is this situation going?
I think the depth of crisis inside the United States cannot be overstated. I think the crisis of the entire imperialist social system that's murdering and brutalizing people around the world are concentrated in the United States, which is the shaky hegemon of the whole global colonial capitalist system. I think what we're heading for, with little doubt in my mind, I mean, you look at what's happening on January 6th, the sector of the settler colonists themselves attack the capital of the government of the United States, and then African people, 10,000 uprisings and protests and demonstrations in 3 month period subsequent to the murder of George Floyd inside the United States itself. I think this trial will result in growing numbers of African people reaching revolutionary conclusions, going back to the place where we had achieved revolutionary conclusions before the United States government unleashed a reign of terror that assassinated our leaders and arrested so many people, put in place a prison regime that has resulted in one out of every eight human beings on earth being in prison, being an African in the United States. I think we're going to see the revolution return full flesh in the United States. And this particular incident with George Floyd is going to prove to be a contribute to that turning point that we're talking about.
All right. And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here on this debate. Founder Uhuru Movement, Omali Yeshitala, out of St. Petersburg, Florida. Writer and social justice activist, Yane Indeko, out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.